Good morning, Santa Fe. Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting, at the website santafe.radiocafe.org. You can listen to the show there anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome Joan Baker. She is a member of the board of directors of KSFR. She is a very active community member, and she is here to help us talk about KSFR. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I am so proud to be a part of KSFR, and I'm really happy to be here with you. So let us carry on and get the station continuing.
Now, you are a donor to KSFR, as in addition to being a volunteer, a board member, and so on. Why do you give to KSFR? Why did you get excited about this station?
About 4 years ago, Tony Branch, who used to be on the board, was at my house. And what had just happened, not to get into total politics, but George Bush had been elected president for the second time. And I can't say it any other way. I was horrified. But what happened to me was that I felt my rights eroding. And I was very scared about it. I've always given to KSFR, probably, you know, not terribly much, 100, 250, whatever. And suddenly I found myself writing out a very large check and wrote them and said, you have to stay on the air. I am so scared that there will not be outlets for freedom of speech. I was very scared about it. So that's how I started. And then Tony Branch, a few weeks later, said, would you like to be on the board? I said, I know nothing about radio, except I listen to it a lot. I love KSFR. And he said, you will learn. I got on the board. I'm now vice president, and happily so, and completely believe in this station.
KSFR is in its pledge drive now. So believing in the station, if the station is something you believe in, then it's time to actually help us. It's been a little slow this year. I'm not really sure why. I'm wondering if there's a sense of complacency, but it's not a time to be complacent. It's a time to actually contribute to the station, yeah, just as you have before. And if you've never contributed to the station, it really is time to start. The number is 505-428-1393, 505-428-1393.
You know,
we're going to be talking in just a moment to Chesa Boudin, who wrote a wonderful book, and we're going to be giving copies away of this book called Gringo. It's a coming-of-age story of an American who went to Latin America, and we'll be talking to him in a moment. But this is really important.
I feel that there is an idea out there that public radio should be free. And, of course, I couldn't agree with that less. But I think in this time, I don't know if it's the economy or that we now have more of a feeling of freedom of speech, freedom of our rights, that, well, I just can't do it. You know, it should be free. And it will be off the air if that kind of thinking continues.
It would be wonderful if it were free, and it would be wonderful if, like the BBC, public radio were supported by the taxes of the people who, in England, the way it works is they're taxed on their televisions and radios. Right. So if you listen to your TV and radio, you're actually required by law to contribute to it. And if you don't listen to the BBC, you have to actually prove that all you watch is reality TV, which is,
yeah,
very hard to do because everybody listens to the BBC.
Right.
Here, we don't have that tax, and so we rely on volunteers, and it's extremely important that everybody step up to the plate and make a contribution, and you can do that by calling 428-1393, or if you're out of area, 866-907-5737. That's 866-907-KSFR.
I think I was just saying to you, Mary Charlotte, that I was just hearing on the BBC that Obama is about to speak at the United Nations, and one of the things that he's emphasizing is that the world has to come together and face the problems that we are dealing with. It is not certainly about the United States. And I thought, well, that's exactly how I feel about this radio, that it is a team idea. You know, when people call in and give their donations, they're allowed to say what they like, what they don't like, and we actually really listen to that. I'm on the program committee, and we take all of this into account. So that's a team spirit.
428-1393. The phones are ringing. Keep them ringing. We do not want one idle volunteer, because idle hands are the devil's playground. Make them work. 428-1393. We're going to start now with an interview with Chesa Boudin, and we'll be back in a little while. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Chesa Boudin. He's the author of the book Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America, and he's going to be here this week in Santa Fe on Thursday at Garcia Street Books at 5 in the afternoon, and again on Friday at Warehouse 21 at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So your parents were members of the Weather Underground, and they landed in prison for very long sentences. When you were a small child, you were raised by Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, whom probably most of our listeners have heard about during the crazy last election cycle. And you also visited your imprisoned parents. What was your political upbringing like? What was your political consciousness like as you grew up?
Well, you know, of course, with a family like mine, I grew up very aware of politics and of the history of politics in our country. And that's something that really shaped my interest in Latin America in the first place and actually led to my first trip to Latin America, which I write about in my new book.
You were at the end of high school when you went to Guatemala to study Spanish. And among other things, you found that the poor and downtrodden people you met didn't necessarily share your political analysis of their situation.
That's right. One of the funny things that I learned right away when I started traveling in Latin America was that my own expectations were often way off. We're often very much out of tune with the reality. And so I would meet people who were very poor, lived without running water in rural areas. And for some reason, really the naivete of youth, I think, I expected them to have a political consciousness about the reality of their lives and the relationship it had to the elites in Guatemala City or to the elites in the United States, for that matter. And more often than not, they had very little political consciousness, very little formal education in many cases, and were much more interested in watching soap operas from Mexico than they were in talking about the history of the CIA-sponsored coup in Guatemala, their own country.
And so when you started talking about things like that, did any of it ever take root? I mean, could you get conversations off the ground, or did you pretty much have to just adapt to what you saw and what they were living?
I think traveling is all about adapting, and I was there to learn from them, not to lecture or organize. And I learned a huge amount about how to do dishes when you don't have running water, about how to get by on mostly just tortillas and beans. And all that certainly shaped my political consciousness and my relationship with Latin America and the world.
What was it about that first experience that made you want to keep traveling in Latin America?
There were a number of things. First of all, the constant learning. Every day, every human interaction was a learning experience for me. I was working on learning Spanish language, so that was a constant factor. And then the different way of life, the different approach, the different outlook that the people I met in Guatemala and other parts of Central America had really helped me think more creatively about my own life, about the world, and about the possibilities for the future. And I found that stimulation, that learning, and that kind of inspiration of creativity really, really addictive.
And so you were just finishing high school, and then you went to college, and usually people took their junior year abroad, but you were, I think, not even a freshman or just about to be a freshman when you decided you wanted to go abroad again. Is that right?
That's right. Well, I had such a good time in Central America before college that as soon as I got to college, I went to the study abroad office and I said, I really want to, spend some time abroad. What's the best way to do it? And they helped me find out about a scholarship from Rotary International. And I had to apply for it my freshman year, but it sent me abroad my junior year. And I did my entire junior year of college in 2001, 2002. At the University of Chile in Santiago.
Now that was an amazing experience, and the timing, the sort of weird fortuitous timing of your travels in Latin America is something that comes up over and over throughout the book, but you were in the
remarkable position of witnessing the Chilean protests on their own 9/11, which maybe you can tell us about, just as the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon were being hit on our 9/11. What were some of the responses to the U.S. 9/11-2001 that you witnessed there among Chileans?
Well, this makes up the subject of a whole chapter of the book. It was a really profound, life-changing experience for me. I woke up on the morning of September 11th, and I got ready to go to school, as I would every other day in Chile, while I was there. And, you know, I knew that September 11th, 1973, was the day that General Pinochet took power in Chile in a bloody military coup that overthrew the democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. And I wasn't sure what to expect, but I got to my campus that morning, and I found there were huge fires in the middle of the main avenue going by campus. There were police lined up. Tear gas was being shot into my campus. My classmates and other students on the campus had barricaded themselves into the campus gates and were throwing Molotov cocktails and rocks at the police. There was a full-scale street riot going on, and it was all I could do to stay out of the way of the flying tear gas canisters and Molotov cocktails. It was in that context that I received a phone call from my family in the United States telling me about the tragedy in New York, the city I was born in. So it was a real shock for me, as it was for everybody, but I was dealing with it in a very different context than my friends and family back home in the States. And I was really impressed with the generosity and the warmth of all of the Chileans I met, who made sure that nobody in my family was hurt, that I was feeling okay. But a lot of them also made a very explicit connection between their tragedy of September 11th, 1973, and our new tragedy of September 11th, 2001.
There was also something that we had kind of more as an underground voice here in the United States, but that was sounded like, from what you were writing, much more explicit there, namely people who felt that the U.S. was now getting a taste of its own medicine and they couldn't just go on doing what they had done to others with impunity.
Exactly. And, you know, I was living with some other students I'd met by putting an ad up around campus saying I was looking for housing. I didn't really know these guys. I'd been living with them for a couple of weeks at this point. And one of them said exactly that. He said he thought the U.S. had gotten a taste of its own medicine. And what he meant by that, what he explained to me, was, you know, the CIA had supported the coup against Chile's democracy in 1973, and then had proceeded to support General Pinochet as he waged a war on the country's left wing, torturing tens of thousands, killing thousands, forcing nearly a million people into exile over the course of the 17 years Pinochet was in power. And so what people like my roommate and many other Chileans who had family members who had been killed or tortured by the Pinochet regime with the support and training of the U.S. government, a lot of them felt that you know, while this was a terrible tragedy for the United States, it was something that in some ways the U.S. government foreign policy had sowed the seeds of.
We're talking to author Chesa Boudin. His book is called Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. And the phones are ringing, ladies and gentlemen. We are delighted to hear that. Keep them ringing by calling 505-428-1393. If you like the book, which is a terrific book. Joan, what do you think?
Well, it sounds fantastic. I'm really listening to him. And I loved just what he was talking about. Now, the underground voice. And how, I mean, freedom is so tenuous. And what we, you know, I don't want to get into the whole thing, but what we did, some of it came back on us. But if one can speak up, it seems to me, is one of the very important answers.
I was reading the book by Chesa Boudin, which you can get a copy of. I've got a bunch of nice hardcovers that they very kindly sent us. The publishers have been wonderful during this fund drive in sending us books to give to you, our listeners, by calling 505-428-1393. But I was reading it and thinking, you know, here's Argentina, a vast middle class country, Buenos Aires, and you know, Italian, very much of an Italian and European mm-hmm. country and particularly city. And from one moment to the next, people like you and me, Joan Baker and me, Mary Charlotte, and many of our listeners
who have spoken out in one way or another, who did speak out in one way or another in Argentina. This is also true in Chile and a number of other places in South America. They're living their lives, they're having their breakfast, they're going to the grocery store, they're raising their kids, and the next thing you know, they are in death camps, being tortured and being killed. And thousands of people were tortured and killed in a regime that looked good to the United States and was, in fact, often supported by the United States, regimes that were military dictatorships in South America. And the fragility of what we think of as a normal existence is really unbelievable and incredible. And so, you know, what are the pieces of infrastructure that actually keep us from getting into that kind of a situation ourselves? I really believe that it's public radio.
I absolutely agree with you. I think any outlet that you feel you can use to speak up, and certainly radio is very easy. I mean, we can all write letters. We can do whatever we want with corporations. Do you think you're really going to get listened to? I have my doubts. So to have a public radio access to me is extraordinary in galvanizing people. And it has. I mean, you probably know many examples where this has really happened.
Well, so many people who have listened to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and I very much believe in local radio, many people have come to me and said, you know, I went to that book event, I met the author, and now I'm doing this, this, that, and that.
Yeah.
Or I went to the music event, and I made some new friends, and now my life is going in a new direction. Or I heard this, and I feel absolutely passionate. I mean, that certainly happened to me. I was pretty apolitical growing up because I grew up in what you might call a mixed household politically, and it was so confusing that I just tuned the whole thing out and was sort of, you know, more involved in nail polish and things like that.
Very important.
It seemed that way at the time, and I do not eschew or shun nail polish even to this day. But what happened was I went to college, and particularly afterwards, I started listening to public radio and was, in fact, politicized and thought, oh, my God, things are not okay. My life seems okay, but it's based on a foundation that really needs to be questioned.
Yeah. Well, I think, as you say, in Argentina, when I think of that country, it's very sophisticated, and suddenly everything turned. But I'm also very happy that KSFR has gotten so involved with one of the things that struck me so much was Jeremy Scahill and writing about the private
Blackwater.
And that, when he did that, and when we put him on the stage, really, sponsored him at the Lensic, I don't think Blackwater was very much a word that people knew or a concept.
Yeah, well, his book had just come out.
Yeah, and so look now, you see often Blackwater being talked about and trying to stop what they do. And there's a great result of what KSFR does.
And we are one of many. And what happens is, in our local community, people support this station. In a community in Colorado, people support that station. And in Texas, they support that station. And everybody supports it so that there is a nationwide movement of people who are in the know and who are willing to stand up and say no, or willing to stand up and say yes when the time comes.
And Mary Charlotte, I have four people who are willing to do that.
Yes, go ahead.
I want to thank Margot.
Yay!
Billy Blair.
Thank you, Billy.
Good. Lori Liverman.
Yay, Lori.
And Robin Laughlin. Oh.
Thank you all so much. And keep those telephones ringing.
And one more thing. We have a $500 challenge grant between now and noon from the ALH Foundation. They'd like to help us repair or replace some of our CD players.
Yes, that would be a very good idea. $500. Let's get $500 between now and 9, and then you can do a new one, if we can get a new one, between 9 and noon. Let's get $500 during the rest of this hour. Should be easy. Give a call, 428-1393, 428-1393. I hope I've said it enough, but
I'll
say it once more.
I thank all those great people, my friends, for calling, friends of KSFR. But I also want to welcome Albuquerque listeners, and I know that they're giving. And I am so happy that, because they have more of a choice in some things, but they're listening to us, and I really want to thank them.
Albuquerque to Taos. Yeah. Abiquiu, Chimayo, Española, Corrales, Rio Rancho, all these places. People are listening to KSFR, and if you're in one of these places and you've never made a donation before, the way it works is listener-supported public radio is supported by you, the community. It's called community-supported public radio because that's precisely what it is. We need your donations. We need your help. We are delighted to welcome you to the extended KSFR family, 428-1393. We're going to hear from two of our beloved underwriters right now and go back to Chase and Boudin. So as you are going about your morning, please remember KSFR. Give us a call, 428-1393. You then went to Argentina, and you were there really during the toughest part of the economic crisis. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, I was just I had a bit of vacation from the university in Chile, and I hit the road. And one of the obvious places to go from Chile is Argentina. It's just across the Andes. And when I got there, I got to Buenos Aires, the beautiful capital of Argentina. I found the country in the midst of a terrible economic crisis, and this is in 2001. And I waited in line with thousands of Argentine citizens who were desperately trying to get their last bit of savings out of the banks before the banks collapsed. And it was a really devastating situation to witness and to have stumbled upon.
One thing I like about reading your book is that it's both a kind of travelogue of a young man trying to find his way in the world and trying to figure things out and just simply being wide open to learning. It's also a political analysis, and you go into some detail about the role of the International Monetary Fund and other institutions and the money laundering that took place and the depth of the corruption in Argentina. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, it's an immensely complicated situation that leads to this financial crisis in Argentina. To make it very simple, and I do explain it in a bit more detail in the book, because really my traveling is always political. I'm always looking to understand the politics of the people and the places I visit. And so a lot of my learning happened right there on the ground. I would meet people, and you know, there was a young woman I met in Buenos Aires that week who had owned a small business, and I learned how and why her business was now bankrupt and what that process was. And basically, it works like this. Argentina had set as a national policy, they'd pegged their peso, their currency, to the U.S. dollar. So it was exactly the same value, one-to-one. And what that meant was, you know, obviously the Argentine peso was not as valuable as the U.S. dollar, and there was much less demand around the world for the peso than there was for the dollar. But by artificially pegging it at the same value, it made it very easy for people in Argentina to import products from other countries because their currency was so strong. Buying things from the U.S. or from Europe was relatively cheaper than it would have been had the peso been at 2 or 3 or 4 to the dollar. So what that led to over time was a strengthening of the import sector and a weakening of the export sector. And it meant that eventually the domestic production base, the companies that made that exported beef or wine or leather or other products from Argentina were going bankrupt. They were unable to sell their products competitively either at home or abroad. And eventually it became totally unsustainable. The government was supporting this artificially inflated currency, and when it got really bad and people realized they were gonna have to allow the currency to float and let the market determine the value, everybody who had pesos and who had access to foreign bank accounts wanted to get their money out because every peso they got out was still worth a dollar. But the next day or the next week, it was going to be worth only 30 cents. And so there was huge amounts of corruption involved in that last you know, month before the devaluation occurred, with companies using bank accounts, international bank accounts, to get pesos out that were still denominated in dollars. And meanwhile, the people I was meeting on the streets were not even allowed to withdraw money in the local currency. And so many businesses that had accumulated debts that were valued in dollars all of a sudden had to pay them back at 3 or 4 times the amount when the currency was devalued.
And so on the street, how were people faring? I mean, what happened next?
everywhere I went, I saw families digging through the garbage. I saw children sleeping on the street in groups. I saw people dancing tango for tips. I mean, everything you can imagine. I saw one old man who had gotten his hands on a scale, like, you know, to weigh yourself with. And he was standing on street corners with his scale, offering to let people weigh themselves for 10 cents. I mean, it was the most desperate thing I've ever seen. And in some ways, what made it all the more shocking was that many of the people I saw on the streets were not people who would have been on the streets 2 or 3 months earlier. I mean, it was not just being a country where there's extreme poverty, which is its own tragedy, and is difficult to deal with in its own way. These were people who had been middle-class professionals. These were people who all, you know, for their entire lives had had retirement plans, health care, had many, in many cases, had owned their own houses, and now were living in the streets, going through garbage to get enough to eat each day.
And meanwhile, the political response was to ask for help from the International Monetary Fund, which then put restrictions on the people even further that hurt the people who were most vulnerable.
Yeah, well, the International Monetary Fund in many ways was, and you know, many people in Argentina felt that the International Monetary Fund was responsible for for the crisis to a large extent, because they had encouraged the currency policies that I just described that had been behind this collapse. And then at a certain point, when the International Monetary Fund realized what was going to happen, at a certain point they just cut Argentina off and they said, nope, we're not going to give you any more money to support this currency policy, even though we encouraged it, even though we helped you design it. And so when that happened, when the International Monetary Fund said, no, Argentina is not good enough to get our loans, that's really what set off the crisis. And so there was a lot of anger, a lot of graffiti on the streets and the boarded up buildings, expressing people's outrage at the International Monetary Fund.
Your travels took you through a number of Latin American countries, and one of the things that you developed, I think first it was probably for budgetary reasons, but then you really seemed to develop a love of traveling by land, no matter how rickety the transportation was, no matter how long it took.
Exactly. I love getting on a long bus ride and seeing where it takes me. It's true that I started doing it because it was cheaper than the plane flights or the other kinds of transportation available. But in the end, I learned to appreciate it, as you said, because it gave me a much more concrete sense of the day-to-day life of the people in the countries I was visiting. And it also gave me an appreciation for the changing culture and geography as I covered land. So I've now bussed or boated pretty much the entire circumference of South America. And I think that, you know, the relationship that I have with the people, with the land, with the terrain, with the food is much deeper than it would have been had I just flown from one capital city to the next, and kind of dropped in on the big metropolitan areas. Instead I got to meet people. They'd invite me to come visit their families in small towns out of the way that I never would have come across otherwise.
And one of the things that you encountered, and this is probably familiar to many people who have traveled abroad, is the incredible generosity of people who you think can least afford it.
That's right. I mean, time and time again, I was just shocked and awed by the generosity and that I was met with. And as you said, usually it was the poorest who were the most generous. And I had people, there was a family that I write about in the book who I stayed with in Brazil in the Amazon in a city called Manaus, right on the Amazon River. And I went back and visited them 4 or 5 times. And every time I was there, they had more, you know, more kids, new people being born into the family. At one point there was 13 people in a 2-bedroom apartment, and they made room for me. They made room for me on a sofa in the living room, and they made room for me at the table for the meals they'd whip up of fried plantains and rice and beans. And their willingness to accept me and include me in their family, even when they were struggling themselves, was a real lesson to me about how I want to interact with the world and how I think our country should seek to interact with the rest of the world.
And even the reflection on your own childhood, and again, this is, I think, so familiar to people who've been changed by travel, is the sort of annoyance of having house guests in your big, spacious house in Chicago when you were little. compared to the just complete delight in having you in some of these other places.
Yeah, well, it was right. It was really flattering, and it was also a lesson in humility and generosity that I hope to be able to put into practice in the rest of my life, because there's no amount of generosity that I could exhibit to foreigners visiting this country or to other people who come my way that would be sufficient to repay all the generosity I've been shown by people in the most unlikely places.
We're talking to Chesa Boudin. He is the author of the book Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America.
And you can get a copy of his book by calling us at 428-1393 and making a contribution to KSFR. We've got some thank yous. Mary Lynn is in the control room.
Yes, Mary and Andy from Tusuki.
Yay, thank you.
Gail Maxson Egerton.
Yay, thank you.
And Saville Ryan.
Saville!
Oh, Saville, and he pledges, or she pledges on...
Great.
I'm just the messenger. Pledges on behalf of Carlota and Joan Baker.
Yay, Carlota being my evil twin.
Oh, great.
The one who spends a lot of time in Latin America. Thank you all. Now keep those telephones ringing. We want to make the $500 challenge. We are getting close, I think, I hope. I don't have an exact number count here since I'm sitting in the Santa Fe Baking Company, but we are well on the way. Let's get that $500 challenge by 9 o'clock.
Oh, 9. I think he said noon.
We're
saying 9. Great. Well, it sounds like we're getting it. I thank all those wonderful people who just called in with donations. That is so great.
Now, I think that the lesson of generosity on the part of the people who can least afford it is a very important lesson. And I'm not just saying this because it's our fund drive, but I think it's something to really take to heart. I have noticed so much that people who are making, a reasonable but not great hourly wage really get how important public radio is. And they'll give $30 or $50, whereas people who are making a whole lot sometimes don't realize that it's just as important to give proportionally.
Well, I think we really need those $30 gifts, $50,
indeed,
whatever, $20. I was at the Collected Works yesterday. We had jazz. Michael Handler was playing. And the out-of-towners who were in there were giving us $5, $10, $20. Well, that really adds up. I was fascinated by Boudin's discussion about the peso being pegged. And again, it just seems to me that we have no idea and should, and many of us do, the false sense of this sort of security, freedom, monetary value. And it's very quixotic, I think that's the word. And he was really talking about that, addressing that.
Very much so.
So the generosity of all of those out there, fantastic.
It is great. Keep those phones ringing, 505-428-1393. We're making this break quick, and we're going to go back to Chesa Boudin so you get to hear the rest of the interview, and we will be back after that. So once again, 428-1393, 428-1393. It's great if you call. You can pledge online. You can send a check. But if you call, I know that you're supporting
this
show.
And we'll hear it right away.
And we'll hear it, and you can pledge anonymously, too. We don't have to read your name, but it's always fun. 428-1393. We'll be back in just a few moments. Here's Chesa.
Another thing that you go into, and only up to a point, perhaps out of decorum or not wanting the book to go too much in that direction, but many opportunities at romantic relationships came your way all over Latin America. And one thing that you found was that no matter how much love, affection, attraction, everything else there might be, the basis of your relationships always has an economic element when there's inequality.
Well, I think, Latin America is a very romantic place. I was 18 when I first started traveling there. So I did fall in love more than once. I met some amazing people, many of whom are still in my life. But you're right, when you have a U.S. passport, when you have a good education, and you have the freedom and the real privilege that I've had of being able to pick up and travel for extended periods of time as a young person, it puts you in a very different category than most of the people in the world. And certainly most of the people that I met in Latin America didn't have those privileges. I, by virtue of the fact that I was in Latin America, was experiencing some of the reality of what the people I might date, live with. I was meeting their families or their friends. I was seeing their cities. I was learning their language. And that opportunity was very rarely available to them. Most of them couldn't get visas to the United States if they wanted to, and if they could get a visa, they probably couldn't afford a plane ticket. And certainly very few people spoke English. So there was a real inequality in terms of our ability to understand each other's world and where we were coming from, and in terms of my privilege of dropping in and dropping out when I needed to go home for anything, or when I wanted to finish my education back in the United States. I flew home and finished my education. And so, you know, I think that disconnect definitely shaped and put certain limits on the kinds of relationships that I was able to build with both men and women.
You call the book gringo, and that's a term which some people think is derogatory, and often it's not. It's just a way of speaking about a person. But how did your status as a gringo, as an American, affect you there? You talk about playing the gringo card from time to time. How did the privilege of being from the U.S. manifest in different places in Latin America?
Well, yeah, it's definitely a theme in the book, and it's been a theme in my travels. You know, a lot of travelers will go through phases, and I'm certainly one of them, where you sort of try to blend in and try to pass for local and try to get your accent to be so good that nobody notices that you're it's not your first language, and you try to dress the way that locals dress. But it's pretty hard when you're 6 feet tall and, you know, have blonde hair and blue eyes to pass for being Guatemalan. So, you know, eventually you kind of embrace your identity. And for me, part of what I loved about traveling was precisely this fact that I was an outsider. And it forced me to be much more aware, self-aware, and self-reflective about who I was, what role I was playing in the country I was visiting, and also what my identity was as an American, as somebody from the United States. And I find it's really easy when I'm walking around the streets of New York or Chicago, where I live now in New Haven, to just kind of take for granted all of the amazing things about where I'm from, about who I am in this country, about what my country represents. When you're in another part of the world and you stand out and you're a gringo and people notice you as being different and are constantly asking you, where do you come from? How do you do things in your country? You know, how much does this cost? It really forces you to appreciate and reflect on the different ways that we do things and what's good about our system, and perhaps areas we can learn to improve.
It's also, I think, a cause for reflection that when people from other countries come to the United States, we're much less likely to ask them, what's your life like? What do you eat? How do you do things in your country? How do you live?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, my experience is that the United States is such a big presence globally in terms of, you know, world politics, economics, culture, that people from all walks of life in countries on all seven continents are really interested in the United States, and it has an impact on their life and it has meaning in their life. But many people in the United States have no idea what the difference between Paraguay and Uruguay is, for example, or couldn't even find them on a map. And so if they meet somebody from that country, or, you know, somebody comes from Belize or from Honduras, it doesn't necessarily have any kind of place in their worldview that allows them to even have a meaningful conversation.
You were in Venezuela, and you actually devote several chapters of the book to that country. How did you end up there the first time, and what were you doing?
The first time I went to Venezuela, I was on a break in graduate school, and I'd gone back down to Chile. This is in 2004. I'd gone back down to Santiago, Chile to visit some of my old friends from when I was studying abroad there. And I ended up hitting the road, traveling north by bus, as is my preference. And I worked my way through Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador. And once I was in Quito, I was staying with some friends there. And I wanted to go back and visit the family that I write about in the book that lives in the Amazon in Brazil. So I got on a boat. It took me about 2 weeks going down the Amazon River. I made it to the town, where this family in Brazil lives, spent some time with them, and eventually decided I wanted to see Venezuela. I'd never been there before. It was one of the only countries in South America that I had not visited, and I was really interested in the politics. I was curious to see what Hugo Chavez was all about. So I jumped on a bus. It took me about 36 hours to get to Caracas, and I wasn't sure what I would find when I got there, and I certainly didn't expect to stay longer than a week or two. But when I arrived in Caracas in late 2004, I got very lucky, and I met some people who worked in the government and who needed a translator. They needed somebody who could translate documents from English to Spanish and from Spanish to English. And by this point, my Spanish was good enough that I figured I'd give it a try. And so my first full day in Caracas, I found myself inside President Chavez's palace working as a translator and kind of getting an inside view of how the policy process works in Venezuela. And it was a real learning experience for me. I didn't know anything about Venezuela, so I had to catch up quickly and try to make sense of all of the controversies and all of the disputes that were ongoing and still continue to this day.
Well, and it's quite amazing. I mean, in the beginning of the book, we find this 18-year-old high school kid who doesn't, you know, who's looking up the most basic words in the dictionary, and now a few chapters later, you are trying to translate really government jargon about agencies and cities and states you've never heard of, and acronyms and Venezuelan slang. I mean, you came a really long way.
Yeah, although I have to admit, that first day, I think I did a pretty bad job interpreting. Like you said, I didn't know the acronyms. I didn't know the Venezuelan dialect. But, it, you know, it worked out, and I stuck it out. I stayed on for several months. And, you know, I think the process of coming of age, of learning Spanish, of getting older, of having a more nuanced and complex political framework than I started with is really the story that I tell in this book. It's my story of becoming an adult, and it's also Latin America's story of its own political transformation.
What did you end up thinking of Hugo Chavez? I mean, there's a lot devoted to that, and you saw quite a bit of Venezuelan politics over time. He was obviously a great proponent of the poor and did a lot of work and has done a lot of work for the poorest people in Venezuela, who, by the way, have a quite a sophisticated level of political consciousness, as we see. Where do you think Venezuela is now?
Well, I think, you know, I think you said it well. I think, you know, Chavez has been very committed to poor people, and it's one of the things that's made him so popular and allowed him to get elected and reelected. And it's also true that Venezuelans are one of the most politically conscious people that I've met in all my travels. And I found both of those things very inspiring when I first arrived in Venezuela. And the idea that there was a government that was really taking seriously the needs of the poorest citizens, not just the ones in the fancy suits and you know, the lobbyists who had all the Wall Street connections. So I found that really inspiring, and it's one of the things that made me stay on. But I will say today, there's plenty of things about what's happening in Venezuela that I find troubling or disconcerting that I'd like to see done differently. I have lots of criticisms. But I also think that the government has made huge strides in empowering poor people to have control of their own lives, their own resources, their own communities, and to alleviate poverty. They've got a model that provides free basic health care to people all across the country. And it's a model that we in this country could learn something from if we were willing to pay attention.
That's so true. And there are so many countries we could learn from, as we've discussed before on this program. So you, in the basically 10 years that you were traveling, witnessed this political shift to the left in Latin America, in one country after another. What do you think is going on there, and what does it feel like when you talk to ordinary people?
Well, it varies from one country to the other, and it's one of the things that I try to make come alive on the pages of my book. You know, I traveled over the course of 10 years, and the region really changed quite a lot. But within each country, of course, there's regional differences, there's cultural differences, and so the kinds of experiences that I had, the kinds of political processes that are going on in fishing villages in the Amazon, in Ecuador, are quite different than those going on in the mining communities in the Bolivian Andes, and again, different from the ones in the barrios in the hills above Caracas. So my goal with this book was to, on the one hand, give voice to those people who I met throughout my travels who don't have access to CNN or to the New York Times, or to make their voices heard in the international setting, and also to and also to try to share the lessons I had learned from those people and from their courageous political experiments with democratic process and economic redistribution with people back here in the United States.
We're talking to Chesa Boudin. He's the author of the book Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. And he will be speaking this coming Thursday night at Garcia Street Books at 5 in the afternoon, and then on Friday at Warehouse 21 at 7 in the evening.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. I just wanted to say how much I love this interview, and particularly when he said, embrace your identity. I traveled in my late 20s, actually hitching through South America, although it took me 3 months to only get to Peru. So it was a slow trip, but I spent quite a lot of time.
Hitchhiking.
It was great. And one of the things about hitchhiking then was that people would stop. And there was one road south, and people would stop and just say, come with me, and I'll take you to my family. And so, again, this is all reminding me of this extraordinary trip. But what I want to get onto is that he was saying how travel gives you such an incredible experience. And one of them is that you stand back and you have to assess cultures. And I was alone, so you have to feel out and have respect for what you are, who you're meeting, and what you are seeing. I think so much we are told what to think, not how to think. And travel is such a perfect example of that ability to gather your own thoughts. And so that's a perfect segue into KSFR. But second, I want to just quickly say thank you so much to Mary Charlotte, because your programming, to me, is the best example of this kind of information. You take it, you assess it, you have the most extraordinary questions, you do great homework, you get to the core, and I think you're the wonderful example of free and public radio.
Thank
and
you.
I said to Mary Charlotte, I wanted to ask of the art of the interview. So if you have because you have it.
Well, first of all, thank you. Joan Baker is a board member on KSFR's board here, KSFR Public Radio, which we are asking you to donate to. We are so close to meeting our $500
great.
Challenge, Joan.
Oh,
I just got a note
oh,
from
good.
The control room. We need probably two more calls to get there. The number is 428-1393. 428-1393. Also, out of area, the toll-free number is 866-907-5737, 866-907-KSFR. Thank you for your kind words, Joan. I know you were going to ask me this, the art of the interview.
Well, it's incredible. You have it. I think interviews sometimes are hard to listen to. Easy to watch on television, but hard to listen to on the radio. And you seem to get right to the person's passion.
Well, I think part of it is doing your homework, like reading the book.
Yeah.
Part of it is respecting the person, whoever they are, and whatever level they're at. And as regular listeners to this program know, sometimes you have absolutely world-class yeah. artists or authors, and sometimes you have people who are, how do I say it, working at the local level
right.
and really doing their best, but aren't necessarily ready for the world stage. Or sometimes
right.
you have students. And whatever level they're working at, to really meet them there
yeah.
and never put them down, but really just ask them things that come out of your own curiosity.
Curiosity, to me, is the key to everything. I have a lot of it. You certainly have
you
a lot of
do.
It. And as you say, you just it's not always the people who are the great authors. I'm afraid sometimes they're not very interesting. But the people, you have found people, and you go to their core.
428-1393 is the number. We've just got 2 minutes left. I think that one phone call came in, but we're waiting for another one to close out this $500 challenge.
And we have several thank yous right now.
Yay! Go ahead.
Jeanette Fisher, because her son wants to grow up to be a travel writer, thanks to you.
Oh, my goodness. That's fantastic.
And your guest. Morgan Smith.
Thank you.
Patty Ravenhart.
Thank you.
And
wonderful.
Margaret Norton.
Wow,
the
great.
Phones have been ringing, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get that last couple of calls in. We've got a minute and a half. You have until the end. I don't know if there's any books left, but if there are, you have until the end of the local news, which is at 9:07 a.m., to score a copy of Gringo by Chesa Boudin.
I want to get it.
Well, you may have to purchase
it. I gave my donation.
Or you can give your donation.
I can get it. And we're also getting checks here, right at the table.
Yes, two this people.
Is unbelievable.
I want to thank Marcella Cruz, who just came in and very kindly handed us a check. Ann Hillerman handed us a check yesterday. People come up to us in the Santa Fe Baking Company and say, we like KSFR. We appreciate what you do. Joan Baker, I want to say a special thanks to you and the board of directors of KSFR for keeping this station going. You are working behind the scenes and doing what needs to be done to keep the station on the air. So is our audience. 428-1393. Prove that you care about public radio by making a donation.
I want to thank all the producers. They're not thanked enough. And the staff. Linda Highhill is unbelievable. She is the manager. And I've never seen anyone who has a finger more on the pulse. Thank you.
428-1393. It's time to go. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I can be reached at the email, radiocafe@ksfr.org. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. You can hear the show there anytime. You can download it. You can put it on your iPod. You can do anything. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc, who is wonderful, wonderful person, wonderful engineer, wonderful member of the KSFR staff for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC. Bye.